Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today we'll hear a talk by Wes Moore, Rhodes Scholar and founder of Bridge EDU, and author of The Work and The Other Wes Moore. The title of his presentation will be The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, January 19, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the sponsors of the E.N. Thompson Forum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mike Zeleny, Associate Vice Chancellor for Research and Economic Development at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
Wes Moore is the founder and CEO of Bridge EDU. It's a unique first-year college on-ramp and career preparedness program. Moore graduated Phi Theta Kappa from Valley Forge Military College and Phi Beta Kappa from Johns Hopkins University. He completed a Master's of Literature in International Relations from Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar. After that, Wes served as a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne Division of the U.S. Army and participated in a combat tour of duty in Afghanistan. Currently, Wes lives in Baltimore with his wife and two children. The title of tonight's presentation is The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. Now let's give a rousing welcome to Wes Moore.
Thank you. Good evening. Bless you guys. Thank you. Good evening. I am so incredibly excited to be here. Mike, thank you so much for the introduction to the Ian Thompson Forum and to the Thompson family. Thank you so much for having me here. This is incredibly exciting for me because not often do you get a chance to really talk about an issue that I really feel is one of the ones that I was actually meant to do, and that is to be an activist. And I wasn't really even quite sure what exactly that meant at first. And what does it mean to be an activist? What does it mean to fight for something? What does it mean to find that thing that you're willing to give everything up for in order to see an impact? And the beautiful thing about it that I realize is that each and every one of us have that level of activism in us. You know, oftentimes when people say, well, what is it, you know, how do we find that level of service? How do we find that thing that we do? Oftentimes I say, well, you know, there is no single definition of service. There's no single thing that we're all supposed to be doing. But it is about find that thing that you know makes your heart beat a little bit faster. Find that thing, find that place that you know where your greatest skills and your greatest joys begin to start overlapping with the world's greatest needs. And then choose to do something about it. And in the same breath, never forget about who it is that we're supposed to be fighting for. And I'm thankful for the opportunity to be here to talk about this issue on such a grand stage. I mean, you walk around and you know that this is the same stage that, you know, Mikhail Gorbachev and Desmond Tutu were on, and Cheryl Wu Dunn is going to be here later on in the year. And so first, for anyone who got the dates mixed up, I apologize. But I am excited to talk a little bit about who it is that we're supposed to be fighting for and who it is that we're supposed to be remembering. You know, the book that we're just speaking about, a book called The Other Wes Moore, and I'll talk a little bit about what that book is and what inspired it. But it was a real learning experience for me because I had no idea the way the publishing industry worked, right? I had no idea that when you pick up a book, and this is any book, when you pick up a book and you open up the book and you're flipping through the pages, what you see on the inside of a book, that is what the author wants to share with the world. That's the author's intent. Those are the author's words, right? Everything you see on the outside of a book, the cover, the title, the airbrushed author photos, the blurbs, all that kind of stuff, right? That is what the publisher wants to share with the world. The publisher will hold on to those rights for a reason. Because the publisher knows that when you walk into a bookstore as a consumer, that they then have 3.2 seconds to get your attention. They've done the math on this. And if they do not get your attention in 3.2 seconds, you as a consumer will just keep on walking and you will move on to the next book, right? So they will do whatever it takes in 3.2 seconds to get your attention. I did not know that. I thought publishers actually cared about what authors thought, right? So about 6 months before the book was set to come out, it was just called Untitled by Wes Moore. They call me in. The entire marketing team is there. We're sitting around this table. And they're like, Wes, what do you think the title of your book should be? Right? They wanted to make me feel like I was part of the process. It was very nice of them. And I said, you know what? I'm really glad y'all asked me because there's like six titles that I really like. And they're like, what are they? I was like, okay, what about Baltimore Sons? Or what about All the Difference? Or what about Out of Many? Or what about End of the Innocence? Or what about Life After Death? Or what about, and I had all these different titles and I had reasons for all of them. And I looked at them and I said, so y'all can go ahead and choose between any of those six titles because I'm good with any of them. And they looked at me and they said, that's very kind of you. And they said, but we think we have a better idea. And they said, what do you think about the other Wes Moore? And I said, that might be the dumbest book title that I've ever heard in my life. A true story. And they said, what don't you like about it? I was like, there's a whole bunch of things I don't like about it. I said, but let me go ahead and start with three, okay? The first thing I told them I didn't like about it was I tried to make it very clear that this story is not just about these two kids. It's not just about one name. It's not just about one street or one neighborhood. It's not about one socioeconomic group. It's not about one race. It's not about one demographic. It's not about one generation. It's about all of us. It's about the decisions that we make in our lives, and tantamount to that, the people who we have in our lives who are helping us to make those decisions. So by putting the name inside of the title of the book, are you not completely negating that entire fact, right? That's one. Second thing I told mine to not like about that title. I said, what self-respected author do you know that puts their own name inside of a title of a book that they've written, right? No, the other J.K. Rowling, the other Stephen King, the other James Baldwin, it sounds ridiculous, right? And then the third thing that I told mine not like about it, I said, listen, guys, no one knows who one Wes Moore is. So why does anybody care who the other Wes Moore is? So I said this to them, and they smiled. And they said, those are actually all really good points. They said, the problem, though, is that you're missing the point. Because you're absolutely right. It is not about you. And it's not about him. The name is completely irrelevant. It does not matter. You can throw any name inside of that book title. Because the truth is, there are Wes Moores that exist in every one of our communities, and in every one of our schools, and in every one of our homes. People who are one decision away from going in one direction or going in a completely different direction. Kids who every day are straddling this line of greatness. And the problem is they don't even know it. The most important thing about the title is not the name. The most important thing about the title is the other. The fact that our society is full of others. People who might not look like us. People who might not speak like us. People who might come from another part of town or another part of the state or another part of the country or another part of the world than us. But people whose destiny matters as much to the long-term safety and security and greatness of our communities as ours does. The others. The ones who we are surrounded by every single day who need and deserve a champion and are silently looking at us in our eyes and asking us if we're willing to be that champion for them. the others. And frankly, it wasn't something that I really thought about or something that I really understood until I was forced to. Because the day after, I just received a Rhodes Scholarship when I was a senior in college, and the day after, the Baltimore Sun, which was the name of my hometown paper, which, by the way, I thought calling the book Baltimore Suns would be a cute play on that. My publisher thought differently. But the Baltimore Sun wrote this article about this local kid who had just received a Rhodes Scholarship. And in the article, they talked a little bit about what the Rhodes Scholarship is and how I was going to be one of 32 American students now going overseas to go study. And in the article, he talked a little bit about my childhood and my background. They talked about the fact that I only have two memories of my father. And how the first memory was when I was close to my fourth birthday. And my mother had a bunch of rules in her house. But one of her big rules was that men do not put their hands on women. And it wasn't until I got older that I realized the reason that she was so insistent on that rule was because of her own past. And she always said, I will never tolerate it if I see it. And I especially will not tolerate it if I see it in my son. And I have an older sister who's like 6 years older than me. And I have a younger sister who's 13 months younger than me. And me and my older sister used to get in, like, when I say fights, I'm not talking about like, oh, get away from me. I'm talking like closed fists, MMA fights. And my mother, every time she would see us fighting, she would always grab me. And she would say, she'd yell at me all the time. She's like, you do not put your hands on women. You do not put your hands on women. And I'd have to explain to my mother and say, but mommy, this is not a woman. this is Nikki. This is different. And my mother didn't see the difference between the two. And then finally, one day, I'm sitting there and I'm on my business. Nikki starts blowing in my face. Like, I told her to stop. She wouldn't stop. She gets up and she runs away. And I get up and I run after her, right? And as soon as I caught her, I cocked my fist back and I punched her. And as soon as I connected, I turned around and I saw my mom. So I knew it was about to get real bad real quick, right? So she starts coming after me. I'm running in the other direction. And the house we lived in was a small house, but there was the bedroom that we were in was basically a closet that they converted into a bedroom when my baby sister was born. So we had a little bed in there for me, and we had a crib for my baby sister. And that was all that was in this room. So I'm running around the room trying to find a place to hide, and there's no place to hide in this room. And then finally, I just kind of sit down, and I get myself mentally prepared for what's about to happen to me. And hear footsteps, hear the knock on the door, door opens up, and my father walks in the room. And when he walked in the room, he sat on the bed, and he put me on his lap. And he started explaining to me what I had done so wrong. And while my job is to protect women and not to hit them. While my job is to protect my family and not to go after them. And he told me that I needed to go downstairs to go apologize to my mother and to my sister. But he told me that he would come with me. And as we're walking downstairs together, I'm holding on to his hand and literally my entire hand wrapped around his finger. And he had this funny way of walking when he walked downstairs because he always stuck his chest out. And so I'm like 4 years old and I'm looking at him and I'm sticking my chest out too. Because my father was everything that I ever wanted to be. And the only other memory that I had of him was about 6 months later when I watched him die. And as tough as I thought I had it, or as tough as I thought my sisters had it, the person who really had it toughest was my mom. Because now here she was, a widow with three children, who was now going to raise these kids on her own, and in no way was this the life that she had expected, or to be honest, the life that she had prepared for. And she was having a really difficult time with the transition. And then finally she called up her parents, my grandparents, who were living up in the South Bronx in New York, and said that she needed help. And they gave the answer that she was hoping that they would give, which is bring the kids up here and we can help. And almost immediately as I got up there, I found myself getting lost.
I found myself picking and choosing which days were worthwhile to go to school. I was saying earlier, I found myself hurting people that actually love me so I could impress people that could care less about me. By the time I was 11 years old was the first time that I felt handcuffs on my wrists. 11. And by the time I was 13 years old, I found out that when my mom makes threats, that she's not playing. Because she'd been threatening this idea of military school ever since I was 8. And she's like, you know, if you don't get it together, I'm sending you to military school. And I'd look at her and I'd say, Mommy, I can see I'm hurting you and I'm gonna work harder. And then when I was 9, she started giving me brochures to show me she wasn't playing around. So I'd look at the brochures. And I'm like, all right, Mommy, I can see you're serious. I'm gonna work harder. And then when I was 10, 11, 12, threats kept coming and I kept on blowing her off. And I kept getting worse. And I kept getting more lost. And then finally when I was 13, she came up to me and she's like, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to send you to military school. And I looked at her and I said, Mommy, I can see I'm hurting you. And I'm going to work harder. And she's like, nah, you're going next week. And she started packing my stuff up. And honestly, even when we got in the car, I thought we would just drive around the block a few times. Kind of like a scared straight thing or something like that. And I'm like, but then she kept on driving and she drove all the way to Pennsylvania. And at some point it wasn't funny anymore. And she shows up at this school and had these big black gates that surrounded the school. And it was wild because in there they would always tell us, you know, if y'all don't like it here, there's a train station right in Wayne. You can go home anytime you want. And so every time they would turn their backs, I would just take them up on that offer, right? And I'd run away, and I'd run through the woods, and I'd try to find this train station, and I kept on getting lost. So finally, after 4 days, I'd already run away 5 times. And I was in my room, and my roommate's there, and my squad leader comes into the room. We call the room to attention. Attention, stay in attention. And my squad leader says to my roommate, he says, get out. I got to talk to more. So my roommate grabs his stuff and he leaves and I'm staying in attention. And I'm thinking to myself, this is not good. Because whatever's about to go down, he doesn't want witnesses. So I'm just standing there at attention. And I'm just waiting. And he tells me to sit down, so I sit down. And he says, listen, Moore, it's obvious you don't want to be here. And quite honestly, we really don't want you here either. So I've actually drawn you a map on how to get to the train station. It's true. And so he reaches in his pocket and pulls out this map. And it's got like, it has a legend on it. It has handwritten notes. It has landmarks. It has pace counts. I mean, he pulled this thing out like he just handed me a Powerball ticket. And there are seriously tears welling up in my eyes. And I'm like, listen, I will never forget you. I'm like, when you get out, let me know. We'll grab lunch, you know. I am just like so excited because I wanted nothing more than just to go home. And he just tells me to get out of there. And so that night I planned this whole big great escape. And they found me in the middle of the woods at 1 o'clock in the morning because the map was fake. The map took me to the middle of the woods. They just enjoyed watching me do circles in the woods in the middle of the night. And I am so angry at this point. I am so, first of all, I'm angry because I'm like, you know, some kind of, I'm the butt of their social experiment. But also I'm angry because I feel like I'm trying to tell these people what I need and nobody's listening to me. I don't want to be here. And they're not listening to me. And so finally they found me in the middle of the woods and they brought me back to campus and we're allowed no outside communication, no phone calls, no radios, television, nothing. It's a chance you're either going to succeed as a team or you will fail as a team and the choice is completely yours. But they said, if we don't make an exception, we're gonna lose them. So they said, Moore, you have 5 minutes to make a phone call. Call whoever you want, we don't care, but you have 5 minutes. So I called the only number that I knew, which was my mom. And she wouldn't expect me to hear from you for about 8 weeks. And now here it was on day 4, 1 o'clock in the morning, she gets a phone call. So she's freaking out. And I'm like, Mommy, thank you for this wonderful opportunity, but I'm really ready to come home. Do you need directions on how to get here? Yeah. I'm trying to explain to this woman who was raising 3 kids on her own what she needed to do to make my life easier. And she stopped me. And she said, too many people have sacrificed in order for you to be there. And too many people are rooting for you. And you've got to understand it is not all about you. She helped me to understand, and time helped me to understand, that the only way that I was going to make it was if my friends and my plea brothers were there to push me. And the only way that they were going to make it was if I was there to push them. She helped me and they helped me to understand that we lived in a completely interconnected society. And the only way that my presence was going to make sense was if I put myself in a position for it to make sense. By the end of that first year, I was doing a little better academically because this stuff actually started making sense and I could play sports because I wasn't on probation anymore. And for the first time in my life, I felt like when people asked my mom, how's Wes doing? She could say he's doing okay and not be lying. And that actually meant something to me. And oftentimes when people say, so was it about the fact that you got picked up and moved or sent here or whatever, did that make all the difference in your life? And I tell them the truth is that what happened to me wasn't the fact that I was physically transported. What happened to me wasn't the fact that I was picked up and moved around. Because I know people that people thought that was going to be the answer, and frankly, all they did was crash and burn. What happened to me was I found myself surrounded by people. Starting with my mom and my grandparents, but eventually leading to this amazing string of role models and mentors and supporters. And people who helped me to understand that the world is bigger than what was just directly in front of me. People who helped me to understand that we lived in a big and a beautiful and a bright world and that I actually had a place in it. People who helped me to get that there was never going to be any accidents of birth, not being black or being poor, not being from Baltimore, being from the Bronx, or being fatherless, that was ever going to define me or that was ever going to limit me. And so in essence, what they did was they taught me what it meant to be free. And so fast forward, I ended up staying when I had the option to go back to school in Baltimore. I ended up finishing school. I joined the Army right out of high school. I went to junior college. After that, I went to Johns Hopkins. And while I was a senior, Johns Hopkins was when the Baltimore Sun was writing this article about this local kid who just got this scholarship. But at the same time, they were writing a whole series of articles about four guys who one day walked into a jewelry store. And the first two guys walk in the jewelry store and they reach in their coats and they pulled out guns and they cocked the guns back and they started pointing the guns at everybody inside the store and telling everybody to get on the ground and keep your hands on top of your heads. And everybody who was inside the store just kept their heads down and they listened as glass kept on smashing around them. 10 seconds later, two other guys walked in the jewelry store, and when they walked in the store, they reached in their coats and they pulled out mallets. One guy with a gun, one guy with a mallet went to the left. One guy with a gun, one guy with a mallet went to the right. They met in the back of the store with a little over $400,000 worth of jewelry. And one of them yelled, let's go. And then all four guys then ran out of the center of the store and then ran outside to the adjacent parking lot. One of the people that was inside the store that day was an off-duty police officer who was moonlighting as a security guard. He was a 14-year veteran of the Baltimore Police Force. He was a 3-time recipient of Police Officer of the Year. He was also a father of 5 who just had triplets. And the reason he was working that day was because it was his day off from the police force and he took on a second job as a security guard to make extra money for his family. And he got up off the ground and he drew his weapon and he ran outside to see if he could stop the guys from getting away. And when he ran outside, he started kneeling next to cars and vehicles to give himself cover. But he didn't realize that one of the cars that he was kneeling next to was one of the cars that the guys were in. window rolled down, and he was shot 3 times at point-blank range, and he was killed instantly. There was a 12-day national manhunt for those 4 guys, and finally, after 12 days, all 4 guys were caught. And one of the people that the police were looking for that was eventually captured and tried and convicted and sentenced for the crime was a guy whose name was also Westmore. And the more I learned about him, and the more I learned about this crime, and the more I learned about this tragedy, the more I realized how much more we had in common than just our names. And one day I just decided to write him a note. And literally the first note that I wrote him was like, "Hey Wes, my name is Wes. Here's how I heard about you." And I had a whole list of questions that I asked him. And a month later, I got a letter back from Jessup Correctional Institution. And it'd be one thing if the letter that I got back from him, if he wrote the letter in crayon or magic marker, or he wrote it with his whole hand, or instead of using words, he used pictures or something like that. Because if that's a letter that I would have gotten back from him, I actually might have looked at that letter and said to myself, "I guess I get it. I guess this makes sense." The problem is I've never received that letter from him. The problem is a letter that I did receive from him was one of the most interesting and articulate letters that I've ever received in my life. And it's only led to more questions. And that one letter turned to dozens of letters, those dozens of letters turned to dozens of visits, and now I have known Wes for over a decade. And it's interesting because I think oftentimes when people say, "So what was the thing? What was, you know, the difference between you two?" And I remember I had someone last year come up to me and they were like, "You know, I want to let you know I didn't like your book." And I'm like, "That's cool." But I said, "But if your mommy asked him, what didn't you like about it?" And they said, "Well, I feel like you tell the story of these two kids, and at the very end of it, you don't give us a single answer. Like, what's the one thing that we can do to help kids go one way or help kids go another way? You don't give an answer." And I said, "Because there is no single answer. Raising kids is amazingly complicated. And when you happen to raise kids in some of the most dangerous and precarious communities of our country, it is that much more complicated. I will debate with anybody who wants to tell me that every child is born with the same amount of assets. Because if there's anybody who really does believe that, there are some communities in this state alone that I would love to take you to and hear you make that same argument. I am a very firm believer that potential in this country is universal. Opportunity is not. And the difference between those two, between potential and where we all end up, is where we all collectively come in. It's where we all collectively come in when we say we are going to choose to pay attention and not simply to be apathetic. That we are going to choose, make a very deliberate decision to understand how these roads do diverge, and then where can we come in to serve as bridges and guides and supporters. What are those things? Who are those things? Who are those people? And when we talk about and we think about the others, how do we make sure that as we're talking about them and thinking about them, that they are then part of a conversation and not simply subjects of the conversation? And so while I know there's never going to be a single thing, I know there are things that do fundamentally matter. One of those things that does fundamentally matter is education matters. And it's not even from the, it's not just from that from the traditional, oh, you know, if you get a degree that you'll have X amount of earning power more than everybody else. All that is true and all that's quantitatively factual. But here's also why it matters. Because education isn't simply just about what you're learning. It's also about who you're learning it from and who you're learning it with. It's about the fact that I had a wonderful session with students earlier, and as I was explaining to them, it's about the fact that 70% of the jobs in this country are filled before they're even advertised. It's about social capital. It's about as you move up in education, your networks will change, your friendships will change, and your connections will change. It's about the fact that I think about Wes's mom. How she was the first one in her family to go to college. She graduated from Baltimore City Community College with honors and then got accepted to Johns Hopkins University. She does 2 semesters at Johns Hopkins University, and then one day she receives a letter indicating that her Pell Grants were cut. I can't help but think how different her life could have been had she had the chance to finish college. I can't help but think about the transformational quality that that could have not just given to her, but her children. And it's not lost on me that even now, a generation later, as she's sitting there watching television and watching breaking news, and they're talking about this murder of a decorated police officer, and when the faces flash up on the television screen about who the police are looking for, and 2 of the faces that are flashing up on those screens are her sons. How there are points of intervention that we know that we can do, not just for these boys. Forget about the boys for a second. Forget about this is the story of one kid who went off to finish high school and college and grad school and another boy who never made it past 10th grade. Forget them. About how there are points of intervention in all of our lives that will have implications generations beyond. And another thing that I know that does fundamentally matter, our expectations matter. I remember once when I was talking with Wes and we were talking about Baltimore. And I remember asking him if he thought that we are products of our environments. Because I heard that expression so many times when I was growing up. I don't know if y'all heard that expression, that people are products of their environments. People are products of their environments. I heard that expression so many times that I never even questioned it or challenged it anymore. Until now, I've kind of come to the point that I think that part of the reason that people use that expression is because they're washing their hands of responsibility. Well, look at the neighborhood they come from. Look at who their parents are. Look at the school they go to. What do we expect? And oftentimes we say that people are products of their environment simply because it helps us to get to bed at night easier. Because it means that there's nothing we can do about it. And I remember I once asked Wes, and I said, so do you think that we're products of our environments? And Wes looked back at me and he said, actually, I think we're products of our expectations. And I thought to myself, he is absolutely right. We are not products of our environments. We're products of our expectations. And someone once said to me, they're like, it's a real shame that you lived up to your expectations and Wes didn't. And I said, actually, the real shame is that we both did. We both lived up to our expectations. Because the expectations that people have of themselves, they aren't born from nowhere. The expectations that people have of themselves come from the expectations that other people have of them. And they simply internalize them and they make them their own. I don't care if you're talking about the State House or Capitol Hill. I don't care if you're talking about business or education or the military or nonprofit organizations. And I don't care if you're talking about state penitentiaries. All of those places are full of people who lived up to their expectations. So the expectations that we have for ourselves and the expectations that we then turn around and have for others, they matter because oftentimes these things become self-fulfilling prophecies. We can't act like if we have low expectations for people that they don't notice, that it's lost on them. We've got a lot of tremendous gaps in our society. We've got health gaps. We've got education gaps. We've got housing gaps. In my opinion, the most dangerous gap that we have in our society is the expectation gap. We just expect different things from different people. And if we can't address the expectation gap, then there is no other gap we're going to be able to fix. How we think about ourselves and how we think about others in relation to the world that we live in, it does matter. Because we cannot pretend like they don't notice. This is our opportunity. I know I stand here right now because there were people who believed in me. I know I stand here right now because there were people who saw something in me before I was ready to see it in myself. I know I stand here right now because there were people who were able to hold up my dreams long enough to wait for my shoulders to become broad enough that I now no longer need their help to hold them. I can hold them on my own. But I could not have done it without them. I stand here today because they're people who actually believed in a sense of freedom. And that I was a kid who might have it as well. And that's fundamentally all we're ever asked to do. That's our activism. To find that thing that breaks your heart and make sure you do something about it. To find that cause that you would be willing to give everything for. To find that thing that you know that you want to be defined by, that you know you are able to move the needle on. And then go move that needle on it. We don't wait for permission. We don't wait for other people to tell us it's okay. We don't wait for people to tell us that it's time. We step up and we fight and we use our voice because we know it's the right thing to do. You know, I'll close. I had a colonel in military school, this military school that I went to. This dude was as tough as nails. He was a 3-time Vietnam veteran. My plea brothers and I said we think we only saw him smile once. And I think it was an accident when we saw him smile. But he loved us. And he was fair. And we loved him back. But he was losing weight really quickly. And one day he called the entire Corps of Cadets together and he told us that he was diagnosed with cancer. And he had to leave the school. And he gave this speech to us that, in essence, turned out to be his farewell address. And he said something to us that day during his speech that I will never forget. He said, when it's time for you to leave here, whether it's time for you to leave this school, whether it's time for you to leave your job, whether it's time for you to leave your community, or when it's time for you to leave this planet, make sure that it mattered that you were ever even here. Make sure that it mattered that you were ever even here, because none of us are promised anything. We aren't promised more days or more weeks or more years. You know, I was telling the students earlier, no one has ever tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, Wes, you've got, whatever, 4,864 days left so you can pace yourself. And nobody ever will. And I'm actually, I'm okay with that. So the only thing that we do know is that while we're here, let's do something with it. While we're here, let's push. While we're here, let's fight. While we're here, let's love. While we're here, let's find that thing that we know that we can do something about. and do something about it. Let's find that person that we know we can make their life just a little bit easier and go make their life a little bit easier. Because if we've done that, then we're doing everything that we have ever been asked to do. If we've done that, then we're leading with love and we're leading with our heart. And we're making our voice actually matter. If we do that, then we're going out and we're fighting for the others, which is the best use of our time. I'm incredibly humbled to not just be part of this forum, but I'm incredibly honored about this idea and this concept of activism. Because in essence, I think it's for all of us, it's our greatest calling. It's why we're here, to find that thing that we know that we want to fight and support. And once we've found that thing, it's the thing we're supposed to fight for and not let go of until our job is done. Bless you guys, and thank you so much for your time, for your service. Thank you.
So sweet, man. Thank you. Y'all are so sweet. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. At this time, Wes will take questions from the audience. Our first question comes from the Ian Thompson International Scholars. How would you recommend that I respond to a friend who thinks that all Americans have an equal chance to succeed?
I would, you know, but this is actually a really, it's a really important question. Because I oftentimes will hear people make the argument, and they'll even say about, you know, kind of, you know, my story where, you know, this is a great example of when someone works hard that they can make it. And I was telling the students earlier, a great example of this is Nick Kristoff, who's an op-ed writer for the New York Times, who's actually the husband of Cheryl Boudin. He contacted me a few years back, and he was just like, I really enjoyed your book, The Other West Morning. I'd like to write an op-ed about your book with the book as the basis. And I said, that's wonderful, and that's great. And he wrote this really beautiful op-ed about how he said, I really enjoyed this book because it was a great examination of race and class in our society. And a few weeks later, I got a message from my publisher who said, great news, Michael Gerson wants to write an op-ed about your book. He's an op-ed writer for the Washington Post, the Washington Times. He's a former speechwriter for President Bush. He's a conservative, right? And he writes this beautiful op-ed where he said, I thought this was a great examination of personal responsibility and the impact of individual decision-making. And I'm like, and I was telling him, I said, oh, this is fascinating. Because really, these are two people who don't agree on a whole lot, who are both saying they liked it and for two completely different reasons. And when my wife asked me, she says, so who do you think is right? I told her, I think they're both right. Because I think you can't talk about societal responsibility without understanding, but at the end of the day, these are individual decisions that are being made. And people have to be held to account for their individual decisions. However, we can't just simply look at individual decisions that are being made without understanding that these decisions are being made in a societal context. And so there is a marriage between these two. So I think one of the things that we have to do when people will make the argument that this is all about if people just would work harder or everyone has the same type of shot, I think it's important to be able to expose people to the fact that that's just not true. It's how we want it to be. And I think we've made amazing strides in order to get closer to that ideal. But when we still have kids who are growing up in abject poverty, when we still have kids who by their first birthday are already have lead-based poisoning. When we have kids who are going to schools that have a 50%+ dropout rate, it's difficult to make an argument that everybody has the same access and has the same opportunity to succeed. And I don't think that's just something that kind of on a affluent versus non-affluent basis. You know, one of the things we actually started doing with our students back in Baltimore, the ones I'm telling you about with the juvenile justice program is, and these are kids with some of the biggest chips on their shoulder. I mean, real reasons to have them too. Kids who, they were just dealt a raw hand from Jump Street. But one thing one of our directors started to do, which I thought was a brilliant idea, he wanted to take some of the hardest kids, some of the ones who have the biggest chips on their shoulders, and he started taking them to Johns Hopkins University Hospital. And he took them to the pediatric oncology unit and introduced those students to a 5-year-old with terminal cancer, whose face lights up simply because she came in to say hello. Take them to the burn unit. Introduce them to that 9-year-old who now has third-degree burns over 50% of her body because her mother was getting high 2 nights ago and accidentally lit the house on fire. And then tell me how bad you have it. Understand there are people on this planet who on your worst day would trade places with you in a second. On your worst day. They trade with you in an instant if they could. We don't yet live in a society where all things are equal or all things are fair or every opportunity is an equal opportunity. But that's also why we keep working together and that's also why we keep fighting. That's our ideal. And until we get there, it just means we have work to do.
Thank you, Wes. Our next question comes from the Ian Thompson Forum Twitter feed. Mr. Moore, as a high school teacher, I'm curious as to what things your teachers did that had the greatest impact on you.
I actually think one of the biggest things that my teachers did, first to that teacher, thank you for your service. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I actually think one of the most important thing that my teachers did for me was they never accepted excuses. And what I mean by that is this. I think I had some teachers in my life who, some were just amazing, amazing people who just helped change me and shape me. And I think I had some who I wish I could have had a conversation with. And for a lot of them, it wasn't even malicious, right? For a lot of them, they were doing what they thought was in my best interest, but it was kind of like, I never had to make excuses because they were too busy making them for me. It was kind of like, you heard about what happened to his father, right? You do know what happened in his neighborhood last weekend. You heard about his uncle got arrested, right? They were so busy making excuses for me that I didn't even have to make them. I had no time to make them for myself. I wish for every teacher and all my best teachers, one of the things they had for me was they understood that you are never doing me a favor when you tell me that I cannot compete with somebody else. You're never doing me a favor by telling me that my bar is lower than any of the other students. You're never doing me a favor by lowering my bar of expectations. You're not helping me out. You're not doing me a favor by telling me I can't compete. Booker T. Washington said something, and I'll paraphrase him, where he said, if you break a man's spirit, you never have to escort him to the back door. He'll walk there himself. You never have to escort him to the back door because he will walk there himself. And so I think the thing that, if I were to put one thing that the greatest teachers did for me, was they loved me and they cared for me And even if they understood my situation might have been different than a lot of kids in school, they never let that be my deficiency. They never let that be my hindrance. They said, I understand it, and I acknowledge it, and I feel for you, and I still expect you to perform. Because what they did was they set the tone in my own mind about I should never, ever put myself in a position or expect anything lower than anyone else around me. That I'm just as good and talented and I'm ready to compete with anybody no matter what. And in fact, what they did was they said, because of some of the things that you have seen and gone through, I actually think in many ways you're more prepared because that's your armor. You're never going to see anything ever again in life that's ever going to make you flinch. And they're right. And that's your secret weapon.
Thank you, Wes. Several of our members of the audience would like to know if the other Wes has read your book, and if so, what was his reaction?
Yes, thank you. And he has. So in fact, and I'll tell you, this is an evidence of where he is. So he read the book about 3 months, 4 months before the book was set to come out. And I sent him a bound copy of the book. And it was actually sent back to me with kind of a stamping saying, this is a prison. And so the way that Wes read the book before the book came out was I literally had to mail him 15 pages at a time. That's how he read the book. Wes is currently in year 14 of a life sentence without parole. Wes is in a maximum security facility currently right now in Jessup, Maryland. I don't even know what time it is. If I looked at a watch or saw what time it is, I could tell you what Wes is probably doing right now, and I have not talked with him today, but the reason I can tell you what he's probably doing right now is because I have his schedule memorized and it doesn't change. And I remember after he read the book, I asked him what he thought. This was probably about 2 months before the book came out, and he said he had two main opinions. He said, one, he said it was amazing how much research went into it, because I literally do hundreds of hours of interviews with Wes, his friends and family, my friends and family, to make sure you're really getting the facts and the feel of the story right. And the second thing was, he said, after reading about his life in a book like that, it's amazing how little that he's done with his life. And but the thing that's really taken me about it is also his reaction to the feedback to it. The fact that we've received thousands of letters from parents and teachers and students. How it's being made part of curriculum in school districts. I remember I got a letter from a teacher last year saying that this is the third time she's used the other Westmore in her classroom. And she says inevitably, every single time she uses it, her kids will tell her, this book is about my dad, this book is about my brother, this book is about my mom, this book is about my sister, this book is about me. And she said she was handing the book out to these students, and she said for the third time they were using it, and she said she was telling them about the story, and she said one of the kids raised her hand and said, this book is about my dad. And she said, you know, I know a lot of kids will say that, and he said it again, and she said, okay, now you're disturbing class day after class. And as he stayed after class and she started talking with him, she realized that the boy in her class is Wes's oldest son. And immediately as she realized that, she apologized, and she's like, Johnny, I am so sorry. I had no idea. I was not trying to embarrass you. We can pick another book. And he told her, he said, my dad wants people to know his story. And she proceeded then to teach the other Wes Moore in her classroom with Wes's oldest son as a member of her class. So I think Wes knows this is not going to impact his life. But I think he does have a real hope that hopefully it can impact lives coming up behind him and help them to understand, even as he said when he was, you know, when he was recommending that I write it. He said, if you can show people the consequences for their decisions and also show people the neighborhoods that these decisions are being made in, then you should do it. And that then became the fire and the focus behind the entire project.
Wes, one last question from our Twitter feed this evening. What is the best thing your mom taught you to help you be the man you are today?
Oh, my gosh. Did she tweet that in? And this is a very personal answer for me. It's not trying to tell anyone else what to do or think. But I think the most important thing that she's ever taught me and tried to teach me and tried to make me and has led by example is she wanted to teach me to love God. I think about my journey and really my journey in faith has not always been a straight line. Where my grandfather was a minister, and I remember we used to have to go to church to go hear him preach, and I remember every time I'd hear him preach, the only thing I was kept on looking for is I would keep looking at the clock and hope that he would be done preaching by kickoff so I can go make the football games. It wasn't until I really got older that I realized that the times when I felt like I was most alone were the times that I was most being supported. And the times that I felt like that so many people had always just given up on me was he was there to remind me that he would never give up on me. And when I went to Afghanistan, my grandparents gave me a pocket Bible, you know, the little New Testament Bibles, and I kept it inside my flak vest, right over my heart. And every mission we went on, I put this inside of my flak vest, and inside of the little Bible, my grandparents wrote, "Have faith, not fear." And I remember I would recite that to myself before every mission we went on. Have faith, not fear. Have faith, not fear. Have faith, not fear. I'm convinced that that was an umbrella that sat over us as we went on our missions. And I think my mother has taught me a whole lot of lessons that I'm glad that she taught me. And she's lived her life and lived an example that if I'm half the parent that she is, then I'm doing a pretty good job. But I think consistently reminding me that I'm not alone and consistently reminding me to love God, that has been the lesson that I think has most served as my foundation with everything that I try to do.
You've been listening to a program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today we've heard a talk by Wes Moore, Rhodes Scholar and founder of Bridge EDU, and author of The Work and The Other Wes Moore. The title of his presentation was The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, January 19th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Katie Cervantes, E.N. Thompson Forum Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.